Hello, I'm Joseph Kassa, and welcome to this podcast where the AI team does a deep dive into some application of systems thinking.
Welcome back to the deep dive. Today, we're going to try something a little different. We're going to teach you how to fish.
Okay, well, I'm looking at our notes here, and I don't see any tackle boxes, no fishing rods, and definitely no worm.
No, none of that. But the source material for today, this amazing presentation by Joseph Kassa called Fishing for DX, The metaphor is, well, it's perfect. It's surprisingly tight.
It really is. I mean, when you start to break it down, the parallels are just, they're undeniable. In fishing, you've got your rod. In radio, you've got your antenna.
Right.
In fishing, you have to read the water, you know, the currents and all that. In radio, you're reading the atmosphere, the solar cycles, the ionosphere.
And the biggest thing they have in common. Patience.
Oh, absolutely. The hours and hours of just waiting for that one bite, or in this case, that one faint signal from halfway across the world.
So our guide for this whole thing is Joseph Kassa. He's had a few call signs, G3ZCCZ in the UK, later VK5WU in Australia. And his career is basically a time capsule of the hobby. We're going to follow the tech from the 60s all the way to, well, today.
It's such a great way to look at it because you see the gear change, but that fundamental instinct, that desire to catch something rare, it doesn't change at all.
Before we really cast off, though, we should probably define our terms. The title is Fishing for DX. So what is DX?
Right, because that acronym means totally different things depending on your field. A doctor hears DX and thinks diagnosis. A geneticist might think of a molecule. But for us, in amateur radio, it means distant transmission.
Distant transmission. Sounds simple. Talking to people far away.
And it is, essentially. But far away is. Yeah. It's all relative. It's not a set number of miles. It really depends on the frequency you're using, the band.
So for a little handheld radio, 5 miles could be DX.
Exactly. An incredible catch. But if you have a huge antenna tower, DX usually means, you know, another continent or some uninhabited rock in the middle of the Pacific. It's about the difficulty.
Okay, so that's our mission. Mm-hmm. We're going to trace Kassa's journey, but we also want to correct a few common myths that pop up when people talk about his work, specifically about things like pileups, what a satellite could actually do, and this legendary $20,000 antenna.
Oh, I can't wait to get to that one. The story behind the price tag is just fantastic.
All right, let's start at the beginning. The 1960s. Kassa is in the UK. And his setup is, it's pretty minimal, isn't it?
Minimal is a good word for it. This is the definition of making do. His microphone, for instance, was just a standard telephone handset.
Wait, like from an old rotary phone, wired straight into the radio.
Wired right in. But the part that really stands out and where we need to make our first big clarification is the antenna. He lists it as rabbit ears.
Okay, hold on. When I hear rabbit ears, I'm just picturing the top of an old TV set. You know, the two metal rods you'd have to jiggle around to get a clear picture.
That is exactly what they were.
So how? I mean, how on earth are you fishing for distant global signals with a TV antenna? I thought you needed these massive wire things for that.
And that's the crucial correction. He wasn't. A lot of people hear rabbit ears and think he's trying to talk to Australia on shortwave. But that just wouldn't work. The physics of it are all wrong.
Why not?
Well, the wavelength. Shortwave signals are physically long, you know, dozens of meters. Rabbit ears are tiny. They're just not the right size or shape to catch that kind of wave.
So what was he using them for then?
Kassa was on the 2 meter band. That's VHF.
VHF. Okay, so that's very high frequency. And that's usually line of sight, right? Like a flashlight beam.
Exactly. It's for local, maybe regional communication. So he's basically fishing in the local pond with those rabbit ears.
But the notes say he won an award with that setup.
Uh-huh.
The 1,000 mile per watt award.
Yes. And that's what makes it so outstanding. 1,000 miles per watt is a measure of incredible efficiency. It's easy to blast out a signal with 100 watts. But to reach 1,000 miles with just 1 watt.
That seems impossible if it's line of sight. The Earth gets in the way.
It does. And that's where the real skill, the real fishing, comes in. He had to wait for these bizarre atmospheric conditions, maybe something called tropospheric ducting, where weather patterns create a sort of tunnel for the signal. He was outsmarting the fish, not overpowering them.
Okay, so that sets the stage. Let's jump forward. It's the 1970s now, and Kassa's in the U.S. He gets what he calls the space bug.
This was the dawn of amateur satellites, a very exciting time. And the one he was tracking was Australis Oscar 5.
Now, when I think of a communications satellite, I think of a repeater in the sky. I talk up to it, it bounces my signal down to someone else.
And that's what most of them do. But this is the next major correction we have to make. Oscar 5 did not do that. You couldn't talk through it.
Wait, really? So if it's not relaying your voice or Morse code, what was the point? What were they fishing for?
Data. Just data. Oscar 5 was basically a flying beacon. It was constantly transmitting telemetry about its own health, you know, battery levels, temperature, things like that.
So you're just listening to a robot talk about itself.
Pretty much. But imagine the challenge. This little satellite is hurtling overhead at 17,000 miles an hour.
So you have to track it perfectly.
Perfectly. And you have to deal with the Doppler effect.
Like when a siren goes, nee-you, as it passes you.
Exactly that. The frequency of the beacon is constantly shifting. He had to manually retune his radio second by second, chasing the signal across the dial, while also physically pointing his antenna at a moving dot in the sky, often in the middle of the night.
It sounds less like fishing and more like, I don't know, skeet shooting in the dark.
The catch wasn't a conversation. The catch was just hearing that beep. It was proof. I heard it. That was the trophy.
Okay, let's move to the next phase. He's living in a city now, Ann Arbor, Detroit. He's in an apartment. A cliff dweller, as they say.
The absolute worst case scenario for a radio hobbyist.
Right. And he's using a mobile whip antenna on his balcony.
And here, unlike the rabbit ears, he is back on HF, high frequency. This is for global communication.
Trying to talk to the world from a balcony, that sounds difficult.
It's a nightmare. You're surrounded by concrete and steel and tons of electrical noise from your neighbors. But he had this really clever technique. It's about how he positioned the antenna.
The notes mention he adjusted it between horizontal and vertical.
This is what's so brilliant. Most big antennas, they just rotate. You know, they point north or east. But Kasser's little whip could also tilt up and down.
And why would he do that?
It's all about something called polarization. Radio waves wiggle in a certain direction, either up and down or side to side. After bouncing off the ionosphere a few times on its way from, say, Japan, that wave can arrive at any random angle.
So if your antenna is vertical but the wave arrives horizontal, you lose the signal.
You lose a huge amount of it. It's like trying to fit a key in a lock sideways. By being able to tilt his antenna, Kasser could physically match its angle to the angle of the incoming signal. Most big fixed stations can't do that. Their antennas are stuck one way.
He had a secret weapon on his tiny balcony.
In a way, yeah. And he used it to do what the logs call punching through the pileup.
Pileup. I love that term. It sounds like a traffic jam.
It sounds exactly like one. Imagine a very rare station comes on the air. Maybe it's a scientific base in Antarctica or a special one-day station from a country that's hardly ever active.
And everybody wants to be the one to talk to them.
10,000 people all calling at the same time on the same frequency. It is a literal wall of noise.
A feeding frenzy. Now, the notes are specific here. This isn't usually a satellite thing.
Right. While satellites get busy, these massive pileups are almost always for terrestrial contacts, chasing countries. There is one big exception, though. The International Space Station. When an astronaut gets on the radio, the pileup is enormous. But see the difference. The ISS itself is the rare station.
Ah, okay. So Kasser's on his balcony, tilting this little antenna, trying to find that one perfect angle, that one polarization that lets his signal sneak through the chaos when no one else's can.
He's fishing for a geometric loophole in the noise. It's incredible.
It is. Now let's get to the 1980s. The computers arrive, and we're not talking laptops. We're talking old S-100 microcomputers.
Green screens, soldering irons, the whole DIY scene. He built something he called the QSO machine.
The conversation machine. And there's a funny story here about the state table.
I love this. It's basically an early chatbot. You have to remember, he's an Englishman in America, so every single time he makes a contact.
Someone asks him, what's an Englishman doing in this country?
Every single time. It got old. So he programmed his computer to recognize that phrase in Morse code or RTTY. The moment it did, it would just automatically send back a pre-written text file explaining his job.
He automated the small talk.
He did, which raises that big question. If the computer is doing the talking, are you still fishing?
Kasser's take was very pragmatic. He wrote, automatic QSOs rack up points without wasting the operator's time.
Wasting time. It's such an engineer's way to look at a hobby. But, you know, it makes sense. Let the machine handle the repetitive stuff so you can focus on the real challenge.
Speaking of engineering, let's get to the legend.
Mm.
The 1999 slide. He's in Australia now. And the slide just says, are you $20,000 Yagi?
The $20,000 antenna.
And a Yagi is that fishbone-looking antenna. They're usually a few $100. I saw that price and I thought, is this thing made of solid platinum?
Yeah, but if you actually look at the picture of it, it's tiny. It's not some giant tower. It's a little thing for the 440 megahertz band.
So what's the deal? Why the insane price tag?
It's the punchline. The antenna didn't cost $20,000. The kitchen renovation did.
The kitchen.
He was redoing his kitchen with this beautiful, expensive wood called Tasmanian Blackwood. And when you do a project like that, you have scraps left over. He looked at a piece of this leftover wood and thought that would make a perfect non-conductive boom for a UHF antenna.
He built it out of kitchen scraps.
Exactly. But his joke was, in the economy of a household, you only get the antenna project approved because of the $20,000 kitchen project. Therefore, it's a $20,000 antenna.
That is some next-level domestic accounting.
It's brilliant. And it goes right back to his build-it-yourself mindset. Don't buy it. Make it better with what you have.
So we've covered the gear. Let's talk about the water itself. His theory of propagation.
This is where he gets a little controversial.
The standard theory is that the ionosphere is like a big mirror, right? Signal goes up, bounces off, comes down.
It's a simple model, yeah. But Castor said, no, it's not that clear. He believed in what he called wormholes.
That sounds pretty out there.
He didn't mean literal space-time tunnels. He meant that the ionosphere is lumpy and turbulent, and it creates these ducts or channels that focus a radio signal onto one tiny spot on the Earth, like a spotlight.
So instead of a signal lighting up all of Europe, it just hits one specific town.
That was his theory. And it explained why sometimes you can hear one station perfectly clearly and nothing else from that same region. A wormhole opened up just between you and them. He even showed how the computer models, based on the flat mirror theory, were completely wrong for a whole year.
And this led him to his final idea, this concept of appointment DXing.
This is the engineer trying to fix the chaos of the fishermen. Instead of the big, messy pileup, you use the internet. You look at the forecasts, see when a wormhole might open between you and a rare station, and you book a time slot online.
Like making a reservation. I'd like to speak with Bouvet Island at 3:10 a.m., please.
And at 3:10, they call you. No shouting, no chaos, very efficient.
Does it take the fun out of it?
That's the trade-off, isn't it? It removes the sport of the hunt. If you have an appointment with the fish, are you really fishing? Or are you just picking up your order?
It really gets to the heart of it. So to sum this all up, Kasser's journey takes us from a telephone handset to an automated computer.
But the core principles never change.
Not at all. It was always about patience, understanding the environment, and optimizing your gear, even if that gear is a piece of leftover kitchen cabinet.
It really proves you don't need the most expensive stuff. You just need to be smarter than everyone else.
Before we wrap up, I just want to leave you with one final thought. It's based on his automation experiments, that Englishman script.
Go on.
We're moving into an age of AI, right? So what if I set up an AI radio operator and you set up an AI operator and they find each other through one of these atmospheric wormholes and they have a full conversation while we're both asleep? Did it? Did it actually happen?
If a robot makes a contact in the ionosphere and no human hears it.
Did we go fishing? Or did our nets just bump into each other in the dark?
What do you think? I think most operators would probably just look at the computer log the next morning and say, yep, got the points.
You're probably right. Well, on that note, we'll leave you to it. Tune your antennas, check the bands, and keep fishing.
Thanks for diving in with us.
I hope you enjoyed today's deep dive. Why not take a moment and join the discussion in the LinkedIn group, Tackling Complex Problems? Take care.